Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we have the great pleasure and honor to be speaking about Abraham Lincoln and about the film, Steven Spielberg's film, that opened last weekend in theaters throughout the country. It has received really rave reviews from pretty much everybody. And we'd like to start by getting us in the mood. This is Daniel Day-Lewis as Abraham Lincoln.
Euclid's first common notion is this: things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. That's a rule of mathematical reasoning. It's true because it works, has done, and always will do. In his book, Euclid says this is self-evident. You see, there it is. Even in that 2,000-year-old book of mechanical law, it is a self-evident truth that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
We have two guests with us for most of this hour. Harold Holzer is one of the country's leading authorities on Abraham Lincoln and the political culture of the Civil War era. He serves as the chair of the Lincoln Bicentennial Foundation. He's a fellow at the New York Historical Society and has authored, co-authored, or edited 42 books, most of them on Abraham Lincoln. His latest book, he says some 5 or 6 years ago, he received an invitation, which he'll tell us about, from Steven Spielberg, that meeting that took place and a request subsequently for him to write a companion book for young readers to the Steven Spielberg film, Lincoln. The book is Lincoln, How Abraham Lincoln Ended Slavery in America. Harold Holzer will be joining us for the hour. Harold Holzer, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Could you please start with that story of receiving an invitation from Steven Spielberg?
Oh yeah, it was a very formal invitation too. It was in an envelope like a wedding invitation, and the request was join Steven Spielberg and your fellow and sister historians at a meeting with the director to explore the character of Abraham Lincoln for his forthcoming film. So I thought that the additional material would be my big summons to Hollywood, but it turned out to be down the street on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, about 20 blocks from where I work. So I took a taxi. Other people were flown in, but I took a taxi in the end. But it was an extraordinary meeting at which about 5 or 6 scholars, led by Doris Kearns Goodwin, whose book had been optioned for the movie, answered his very precise and impassioned questions about Lincoln's marriage, his family life, his true views on slavery and colonization, his oratorical gifts, his writing talents, the sound of his voice, the look of his walk, and a very, very memorable day, about 8 or 9 hours worth of talk.
And you had no idea what part of Lincoln's life Spielberg was going to center on for the film. Were you surprised by the choice, and was it a good choice?
I was absolutely unaware of it, and in fact, the focus on the fight to pass the resolution for the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was more of an evolutionary process, I gather, than a decision. I was out of the loop for years. But I heard stories because I knew actors who were involved in the readings, and I speak to Doris Goodwin often, and clearly they were trying to find a manageable part of the story, and the climactic story of the battle to pass the 13th Amendment is a brilliant choice, because in fact, except for my young adult book really and one scholarly book that may be well be out of print, there really hasn't been any literature on this, and there hasn't been any acknowledgement of Lincoln's very strong hand in convincing Congress that this had to be done now. He says, now, and he pounds the table in the movie. A curious choice, but it becomes evident through the film, as it should have been in more of our books, why now, why then? And how crucial it was that this may have been the one narrow opening. It was sort of like the fiscal cliff that we're facing now. This was the racial cliff. Had to be done right away, or we were going to fall off a cliff maybe until the 20th century. Mm. So it was a brilliant choice, I think, and eager to hear what people think and what critics think and what the viewers think.
Oh, yes, so am I. This is going to be a wonderful hour. And let's bring in our film reviewer. Allison Wilmore is a film critic at MovieLine.com. Allison, thank you very much. She reviewed Lincoln, of course, for MovieLine. Thank you so much for joining us. Oh, there we go. I had the wrong fader up. Hello, Allison.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for being with us. Our Harold Holzer, and the two of you are on together now, has said that Daniel Day-Lewis, let's talk about him at the beginning here, because he is the film in many ways. It is about Abraham Lincoln. He has said about Daniel Day-Lewis, that's why it's so brilliant, because it's one person imagining it, not being tied to previous films, not being tied to photographs and statues, but ingesting a ton of reading about Abraham Lincoln, which I understand is what Daniel Day-Lewis did. I've done a ton of reading about Lincoln as well, not as much as Harold Holzer, certainly, but he was very satisfying. The portrayal of Lincoln to me was just very moving. You could tell that he had spent a lot of time reading about him, finding his voice, thinking about him, and I thought it was an exquisite performance.
Yeah, I thought he did a terrific job and really found a real humanity in his portrayal, where, you know, I think that when playing a character like this, there's always that danger of this wax museum quality where there's so many iconic elements of the character that it doesn't seem like a flesh and blood creation. But I think that there's a real warmth and humor and vulnerability at times to Daniel Day-Lewis's performance that is pretty remarkable. You know, I think that there's also a quietness to it that, instead of doing a very kind of showy take, he really finds a lot of complexity in the quietness of his portrayal.
I know, Harold, that a lot has been written about, and Daniel Day-Lewis has talked about, we'll hear this clip actually, about finding Lincoln's voice. Because you need, we hear the voice, and you need to portray it in a certain way. We hear it as this high, squeaky voice is what we've heard about him. What do we know about the way that he spoke? One of our listeners, Valerie, asked, how do we know what his voice sounded like, and how did Lewis find this voice? And Allison, you probably know the answer to this as well. Harold, start with you.
Well, what we have to rely on in the, you know, the frustrating absence of recorded history of Lincoln's voice. I don't think we have a presidential voice until Taft or Wilson recorded on audio recordings. What we have is the testimony of his contemporaries, and all of them say that he had a high toned but piercing voice that managed to be heard in large crowds. Remember, and you see this in a set piece at the very end of the film where Lincoln delivers his great second inaugural address, not softly, as too many actors have done. It's a very elegiac speech, and the tendency is to whisper with malice toward none, with charity for all, because it sounds like a prayer. But in fact, he's trying to be heard by 15,000 people, and I think that Day-Lewis does the right thing. He shouts it out. You know, he tries to vary the tone. But Lincoln could be heard. The only thing that, I mean, it's hard to recreate and hard to imagine, is that almost all of his contemporaries said that his voice needed a lot of time to warm up. And 10 minutes is what you hear in a lot of contemporary observations. After 10 minutes, the fire in his eyes and the smoothness of the gestures sort of reconciled, and his voice took on an easier quality. But in the beginning, it sometimes could be a little bit startling, apparently. Mm-hmm. And that was probably a combination of the high pitch, because most political orators of the day had, you know, booming baritones, and the awkwardness of gesture. So it took a little while for it to warm up.
Hmm. And Allison, I have read that it took a long time, and it almost as though it was a gift sent from somewhere else for Daniel Day-Lewis to find the specific voice. And it's not just the timbre of a voice, how loud it, how high it is or how low it is. It's the inflection. It's conveying a person's soul in a way as well, which I understand Lewis spent a lot of time listening for that.
Yeah, you know, he's an actor who clearly does spend a lot of time on finding a voice. You can see in Gangs of New York, he has that very distinctive accent. And I think here, you know, for a character who is obviously spends a lot of his time making speeches, that he finds something very unique. You know, I can't speak to the authenticity of it, but I think it feels very genuine.
Mm-hmm. Harold, let's talk a little bit about historical accuracy here and portrayal of Lincoln. There are people who have said that his real feelings about slavery were that he believed that the African Americans were inferior people, et cetera. They hold to a time when he said something. Without getting into a huge discussion, although it is warranted to have some discussion about his evolution, his evolutionary views on slavery, where he was and where he came to, you have said that he was a genuine anti-slavery heroic liberator, and it's about time he got that reputation back because he deserves it.
Is that I who said that?
You said that.
Good. I'm willing to stand by it.
All right.
You know, did he believe for a surprisingly long time, along with the overwhelming majority of white people in America, that there could never be a biracial society here, that northern and southern whites would not be able to adjust to African Americans living in equality with them in the cities and rural areas of the country? Yes. It was not. There were, you know, a tiny percentage of people who advocated for an integrated society in the 1850s and 60s. But what Lincoln said uniquely amidst so many racial epithets that were hurled in political debates and in newspaper columns, really things that should have disgusted people then and certainly appall us today, is that everybody, regardless of color, has the right to eat the bread that they earn with their own hands, that opportunity is equal, that natural law says everybody is equal and starts from the same place. And it is evolutionary. The Lincoln in the Spielberg movie is fighting earnestly and desperately to end slavery in America once and for all, with that, in a way that can never be overturned by a court. And he does it because he thinks that America can't survive without removing that cancer from the society. And by that time, he had come to believe that African Americans could coexist with whites and vice versa. 3 days before he died, he gave what turned out to be his last speech. He didn't know it was going to be his last speech, of course, but he said in the speech that we should begin thinking about extending the right to vote to intelligent African Americans and to those who serve in the Army, which, of course, sounds like means testing today and sounds horrible, but the first time an American president ever mentioned voting rights for black people, and one of the people who heard that speech in the audience was John Wilkes Booth. And he turned to his friend and said, that's the last speech he'll ever make. This means Negro equality, and he didn't use the word Negro. So it's very important to put this all in the context of the mid-19th century and what the vast majority were thinking. In that context, Lincoln was a genuine liberator, mm-hmm. and always, always anti-slavery, mm-hmm. from his childhood.
And the film does, tell me if you think, Allison, it does it successfully. Is it, we're in that context, we're in that debate in the U.S. House of Representatives. We're hearing language that, to our ears, is absolutely appalling about what some people thought about slavery and what they thought about African Americans. But there it all is. That was what was happening, I guess, historically at that time. Were they successful in being able to give us the language in its raw form and the suspense and the debate that took place in 1865?
I thought that was one of the best parts of the film, was the way that it had this very, you know, moral drive meeting the floor of the House and having people with very different opinions in both parties and very different goals, and how that debate took place, but also how alliances were formed and how different people were won over either through, you know, ideological means or through being offered a position somewhere. I think that debate, and, you know, Tony Kushner wrote the adaptation or wrote the screenplay, and I think has such an enjoyment of the back and forth as harsh as some of that language is, I think it does give you a sense of the divide and the kind of fractured viewpoints on this thing that seems very, these days, like a very clear choice.
Mm-hmm. It almost, I think, would have helped if people had read, we'll give a plug for your book, Harold, his book, or knew something about all the characters involved, because you're thrust right into the middle of all of these personalities, huge personalities, and I think it might be a little difficult at first to figure out who the people are in this film and how important they are and where their stands are and who their alliances are and who's one of Lincoln's friends and who he needs to persuade. There is so much there. Did you find it confusing at all? Is it confusing? Do we need a written guide to this, Harold?
I love that question. Do you need a written guide? So here is the written guide. Because and you know, it's written as a young adult companion book, but, you know, it seems to be, I've just been to Gettysburg with Spielberg for yesterday's 149th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address.
Oh.
I signed a lot of books, and it's adults who are saying, you know, this is the story I need for to understand all the characters. We actually have a dramatis personae at the end of the book with who were the pro-amendment congressmen, who were the anti. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, it's sort of like a Shakespearean screenplay in a way. It's a lot
yes.
of people coming in and out of the scene. I mean, you get the sense of who's for and who's against, but it's a big jumble of personalities, as Washington was and as Washington is.
Mm-hmm. We took a group of listeners to Washington and to Gettysburg about a year and a half ago, Harold, and I just stood at that place where he delivered the Gettysburg Address and was informed as to the smells that he was receiving when he gave that in the scene. And it just, it's hard to not have this man enter your soul in a way, isn't it? And that's why I'm so glad this film was done, so that it can enter the souls of so many people, because he was such a huge figure, such a complicated figure, such a moral figure, and he's so important to know about.
And Spielberg was quite, you know, he helped me because helped me communicate, I think, better about the film from here on in, because I've been getting, you know, questions from you know, nitpickers and Trivial Pursuit players,
yes.
and others about little details that they found to be off. But, you know, he said in his speech that he loves the historians and they have informed him, but it's not his job to recreate history. In fact, historians should admit that they can't recreate history perfectly either. It's his job to fill in the blanks in memory and to do it through art and imagination. And so I think it's a wonderful explanation for, again, this sort of Shakespearean quality. I'm sure Richard III's fans would have complained about his portrayal of Shakespeare's play.
But
you sort of have to go with it as literature, as we've just heard. It's quite a dense and brilliant screenplay. The dialogue is unbelievable.
Was it hard, do you think, particularly for people who aren't familiar with all of what was happening historically, is it hard to take all of that in at the beginning of the film, Allison?
Well, it is a lot of characters, and I think that it takes a little while to understand where everyone stands, but I didn't really have a lot of trouble. I think that there are so many fantastic actors, you know, there are so many character actors in this who make even smaller roles really stand out, that I think that helps a lot to kind of delineate who stands where and to remember, you know, just based on a little bit of screen time.
Would you like to highlight some of those performances you found particularly outstanding?
Oh, well, you know, Tommy Lee Jones, I wouldn't call him a character actor, but I think he does an amazing job. He does get a lot of the great lines, the great fiery lines in the film, and is very funny as well. I also liked Michael Stuhlbarg.
Yes.
I think that Lee Pace does a very good job.
What's wrong with Michael Stuhlbarg?
Oh, I don't remember the name of his character, unfortunately. He's convinced to, he believes that slavery is wrong, but has to be convinced.
You're right. I think he was really effective.
Yeah, he got kind of a big dramatic moment when he called out his,
yeah.
You know, how he voted.
Yeah.
Which is very moving. I think that, you know, even in James Spader has a very Shakespearean quality as one of the operatives sent around to recruit Democrats. In just like so many small roles, you have these great actors. Jared Harris as Ulysses Grant, you know, is on screen for very little time, but he's so memorable and just kind of infuses his character with so much complexity in a small amount of time. So I think there's a real appreciation for actors shown, and that helps a lot to deal with the vast array of characters being put on screen.
Mm-hmm. Michael Stuhlbarg played George Yeaman.
Right.
Yeah.
Could I just put in a vote for Sally Field?
Yes.
I don't think that I've seen Julie Harris and Geraldine Page on stage and Seda Thompson on television and Mary Tyler Moore on television and Ruth Gordon in the movies. I don't think anyone, well, Seda Thompson was unbelievable, but it's 20 years ago on bad video. I don't think anybody has come as close to Mary's complexities or appearance or pain that she's constantly suffering and determination and feistiness than Sally Field did. I thought she was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that a profound relationship in many ways? He really did have to put up with a lot with her spending, with her uncontrollable sadness, and he had his share of sadness. I was listening to Sally Field being interviewed yesterday, and I was wondering if there would have been a Lincoln presidency if it had not been for her. What do you think about that, Harold? She was ambitious. Did he have the same kind of drive? Did he help create that for her? And then she seemed to be horrified that she was in that position.
Well, I absolutely think that there wouldn't have been a Lincoln presidency. I mean,
really,
think of Hillary and her impact on Bill, at first behind the scenes, but in the 20th century, in the late 20th century, a woman has the right and to participate in the body politic. Mary is a smart woman. She's been to school. She speaks several languages. She's anti-slavery. She's political. She knows politics. She knows poetry. Lincoln certainly marries higher up. You know, he marries up when he gets Mary to say yes. And sure, it was a tempestuous relationship that we can only begin to fathom. But everybody is always sort of prone to be angry at Mary because she was less than a docile, adoring wife. She's not Nancy Reagan staring up in beatific admiration of her husband. She's a critic. But, you know, I'm sort of reminded of Betty Ford in a way. Betty Ford was sick, publicly ill during a terrible crisis in this country, an inflation crisis, and nobody was angry at her. They sort of made her a great hero, and she became one of the most popular women in America, even when she was battling with substance abuse. People are just unfairly angry at Mary because she had troubles of her own, and forget that Lincoln was not an easy person to live with either. He left her alone with two boys fully half of every year for the first 4 or 5 years of their parenting. He was pretty remote, pretty absent, and not very communicative. So they deserved each other in the best and worst senses of the word.
And what did you think of her performance, Allison?
I thought she did a remarkable job. And also just the scenes between her and Daniel Day-Lewis in private, I think, did a lot to show another side of Lincoln that you might not have otherwise had a chance to see. You know, you see him working within the world of politics, but those scenes really give a kind of more complicated personal look at their lives together that I think do a lot to give, a bit of more humanity to that portrayal. I think that the two of them are so good together that those scenes are so fiery and so emotional and, unexpected.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to our audience here in just one moment. We're talking about the Spielberg film Lincoln, which has just been released. Those of you who love reading about and thinking about Abraham Lincoln as much as all of us do have probably already seen the film, or some of you may want to know a little bit more about the time in history as you prepare yourselves to see the film. We have two guests with us, Harold Holzer, historian, scholar, chair of the Lincoln Bicentennial Foundation. He is a fellow at the New York Historical Society. He, for purposes of our conversation, has written a wonderful guide. It's a companion book to the Steven Spielberg film Lincoln. It's titled Lincoln, How Abraham Lincoln Ended Slavery in America. And as you heard him say, he was at Gettysburg with Steven Spielberg to mark the 149th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. He is with us. Also joining us for a little while longer is Allison Wilmore, who's a film critic at MovieLine.com. You may want to read her review of Lincoln. We'll take your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Because this is a film about Lincoln, I'm centering some of the clips on Daniel Day-Lewis, who is totally captivating. So before we go to your phone calls, this is Daniel Day-Lewis in an interview talking about what we were talking about earlier, this whole process of developing Lincoln's voice for this film.
I hear a voice, if I'm lucky, and this is a voice that is in my mind's ear, so to speak, and that is already a door opening, after which I then try to reproduce that sound. You know, with all these decisions, conscious or unconscious, that we make, there is no guarantee. You have no idea whether this is the right path that you're taking. But when I do take it, I take it in good faith, and I believe in it. So if I hear a voice, I tend to believe that I hear it for good reason. Right. And then the main work becomes in trying to discover that voice in one's own body.
You're listening to the Ideas Network, and we're talking about the Steven Spielberg film Lincoln this hour of the program. We mentioned, both of our guests did, Tommy Lee Jones giving a terrific performance as the abolitionist Thaddeus Stevens. Here's a little bit of his performance.
How can I hold that all men are created equal when here before me stands stinking the moral carcass of the gentleman from Ohio? Proof that some men are inferior, endowed by their maker with dim wits, impermeable to reason, with cold, pallid slime in their veins instead of hot red blood. You are more reptile than man, George. So low and flat that the foot of man is incapable of crushing you.
How dare you?
Talk about finding a voice. He really has a voice, doesn't he, Harold?
Tommy Lee Jones, amazing. Maybe not exactly Thaddeus Stevens, but who cares? he's extraordinary, and he's got one of the great, several of the great climactic scenes of the movie. He better brush up his. I don't know. I'm a big Oscar follower. Maybe all historians love Oscar stuff, but I keep thinking that this is going to be a big. I'd love to hear what our colleague thinks about Oscar chances if she gets into that, but. This could be a sweep of categories.
I'm thinking the same thing. I'm thinking that. What do you think, Allison?
Oh, definitely. I mean, like, Daniel Day-Lewis is definitely a shoo-in for at least a nomination, but I think is probably the forerunner in Best Actor. Sally Field, Tommy Lee Jones, you know, they're all great performances and also the type of performances that Oscar tends to appreciate.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And David Strathairn, by the way.
Yes, oh, yeah. He was marvelous, great. I thought. Seward, wonderful performance.
Looks like Seward, acts like we expected Seward to act as sort of a powerful ally, lieutenant, but, you know, a strong person in his own right.
And, mm-hmm.
You know, he's a real New York Paul, and he really acts it.
Yeah, he does. Allison, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for your review. We'll invite you again to talk about more movies for us. Thank you.
That's my pleasure.
Allison Wilmore is a film critic at MovieLine.com, and she has reviewed film. Harold is staying with us for the rest of the hour. And let's go to Kristop from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Kristop.
Hi, it's Christopher Kulovitz from Dubuque, Iowa.
Hi, Christopher.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm, first of all, an amazing program. I just saw Lincoln last night here in Dubuque, and I'm also the executive director of the Julian Dubuque International Film Festival. So it was pretty remarkable to see such a huge studio film and that did it so brilliantly. I felt like I was having a history lesson while I was watching it and forgetting all the beautiful things that Lincoln did. And at the same time, it was so amazing to me to watch the film coming off of such a volatile election, obviously having, you know, a black president. And you're right about the language. It took me back a few times. And then I had to realize that type of rhetoric still goes on. And it was funny. It was like watching two films at the same time.
Can you talk a little bit about why Steven Spielberg decided to wait till after the election to release this film? And I'm wondering, as we were wondering on our group that saw this, if there had been the film perhaps would not have been as big a success if the election had gone the other way. What do you think, Harold?
Well, I've never asked him, and I did spend some time with him yesterday, but it's a great question. I've assumed from the beginning, having read the screenplay, that, you know, he's a big Obama supporter, undisguised Obama supporter, and the rumor around, you know, our circles was that he did not want to put out a movie that showed how a president can bend Congress to his will so effectively in a good cause and invite negative comparisons to President Obama, who has had his problems doing that. And then on a more obvious scale, some people said, well, he didn't want to do a movie where the Republicans were the good guys and the Democrats were bad guys because he didn't want to confuse people. Any old theory is good, but, you know, it is a great political lesson for the present that if you push and push, maybe things can be done. Of course, you can't do some of the things that Abraham Lincoln did in real life and in the movie, which is offer people jobs and money and other concessions that aren't even discussed in the movie because they're so complicated, in order to get a bill passed. The good old days, right?
Right, yeah, exactly, the good old days. I'm interested in more of your thoughts about the film, Christopher.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where you were talking about the performances as well, and I loved Allison's comment on the character actors that had very small scenes.
Yes.
Really, really shined. And where you would, in another film, possibly forget them, these are people who really had moments on the screen that were hard to forget. And she referenced the one, and I don't remember the gentleman's name or the actor, but he literally has a cathartic moment when he realizes that what he's doing is changing history. And he almost shudders with the excitement, and I was very moved by that. I mean, and I also, the other thing I loved was Daniel Day-Lewis had the ability to play Lincoln in such a, he was the storytelling aspect that he loved, and characters in the film would be like, I don't want to hear any more stories from you, and he was a brilliant storyteller, and yet funny, very witty, where you didn't expect it.
Yes, I agree. Thank you. Thank you, Christopher, so much for the call. The humor, it was wonderful that they used they picked the right stories for this film, too, and the way that he told those stories was so Lincoln-like, wasn't it? You hear about his use of humor and his kind of bawdy stories, but he did it in such a refined fashion, really.
He did, and, you know, he... one of my favorite stories about his stories is his admission that he was a retailer of stories, not a wholesaler. He didn't invent fun. He didn't say funny things ordinarily, but he had this amazing capacity to remember stories that he'd heard, and some kind of a computer-like brain that reminded him that something that was being discussed, you know, would call to mind a tale that would just shed light on a situation in the simplest terms. And the story he tells in the movie is a particularly bawdy one, but there were others that were just sort of homespun. You know, when scientists and inventors were bringing Lincoln and the Naval Board the idea of an ironclad warship, the plans were just so, you know, otherworldly, Jules Verne-ish, futuristic and improbable that most of the professionals said, you know, I just don't think you know, we should spend money on this. Of course, the fact that they did saved the Union practically from the Monitor, from the Merrimack. Mm-hmm. And Lincoln looked at the plans, looked up and said, you know, gentlemen, this reminds me of the story of the beautiful woman who put on a stocking, and somebody looking said, I think there's something in it. And just with that simple allusion, they agreed to go forward and build the first ironclad ship. So it was that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Nobody would know why, how he came up with these things.
Right.
But he was
right.
Famous for it in his day. The voters knew about it. You know, some criticized it and some found it very heartwarming.
Thank you, Christopher, so much for your call. Margaret in Madison. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Have you seen Lincoln? We'd love to hear your review as we speak with a historian who wrote, actually, the companion book for the Steven Spielberg film. Harold Holzer is our guest. His book is Lincoln, How Abraham Lincoln Ended Slavery in America. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Margaret.
I want to ask you a question about December 20th, 1862, when 38 Lakota warriors were hanged on presidential order. I'm wondering if that was included in the film.
It is the Mankato Sioux tribe, and the moment is not included in the film, and it's a very important moment, and I never go to the Northwest to speak on Lincoln when I am not asked about this. And you can look at it two ways. It is the largest mass execution in American history, and it is an execution of Native peoples. But Lincoln had been asked to approve more than 300 death warrants against a group of American Indians who had killed white settlers and committed other atrocities in their own quest for their version of freedom in America. And refusing, even in this busy time with the final Emancipation Proclamation due in only 10 or 11 days, Lincoln reviewed each case systematically and individually and passed judgment on each one, concluding that only accused people who had actually murdered or injured or sexually attacked people would be executed, not those who were with them. So, in fact, he showed amazing restraint in this very controversial episode.
I need to ask you about a little bit of criticism that has come from some people in the African-American community about this film, and perhaps some Caucasian people as well. But you probably saw this op-ed piece in the New York Times last week from an associate professor of history at Northwestern University who writes, Kate Mazur. I don't know how to pronounce her name for sure.
Mazur, I think.
Mazur, is it? She says that the film's determination to see emancipation as a gift from white people to black people, not as a social transformation in which African-Americans themselves played a role. She was looking for a stronger African-American presence, even at the margins of the film. What mm-hmm. Is that a valid criticism, do you think?
Well, I think it's a valid criticism of the entire historiography of freedom, and not enough attention has been paid to the role that enslaved people and their African-American advocates played in securing freedom, and it was a very important role. In the end, African-Americans had no votes, and Abraham Lincoln thought that whatever freedom policy was adjudicated had to be done through governmental action, and the governmental action was Lily White in 1862, 3, 4, and 5. So, yeah, there's a lot of truth to it, and is there a strong African-American presence in the movie? Well, there are some African-American soldiers who tell Lincoln, you know, we've got to have equal pay. And they point out at the very beginning of the movie the real problems and the real perplexities of the age. Here are African-American soldiers. Abraham Lincoln, the first president to permit and welcome the enlistment of black troops in the United States Army, but they're getting paid less than white people. And instead of getting a bounty to buy uniforms, they're having to pay for the uniforms out of their smaller paycheck. It wasn't easy to get to it was a challenge to get to perfect equality, and Lincoln did it in very small steps. But I don't think it's fair to say that he wasn't the major player in the country in that march toward freedom for all of the things that the other, you know, the work of congressional Republicans like Thaddeus Stevens, who's in the film, or the advocacy of black leaders like Frederick Douglass, or the African-American soldiers themselves, or slaves who took lives in their own hands by running away from the plantation. And seeking refuge behind Union lines or the Republican Party or a whole number of groups. Mm-hmm. But Lincoln was the president. The buck stops there.
Mm-hmm. And was it historically accurate in how he really pushed for this, how it was his main focus for those months? Did he become very personally involved? Was he counting the votes? Was he devising all of the strategy?
He was. He definitely was counting votes. But it's always, a miscalculation. But, it's the way you have to telegraph things in a movie. It's always a miscalculation that Lincoln, to think that Lincoln ever had the leisure to focus on one crisis at a time. He had global affairs to consider. He was writing arguably the greatest speech of his life, the second inaugural address, when all this was unfolding. He was beginning the task of organizing a second term government, just like President Obama is now. He was watching military actions much more intently than the film has the leisure to suggest. He was at the front, not only hanging out on the back porch with General Grant, but he was directing strategy. He was asking pertinent questions. He was touring Richmond, which was an amazing event, greeted as a liberator by the African-American population there, and counting votes. So there was no peace, no rest, and no single issue at any one time.
Yeah, and can you ever see that in his face in this film, can't you?
Yeah, yeah.
No rest, no
peace.
And
if we don't see it, Ulysses Grant tells us. You've aged 10 years since I last saw you.
Right. Ed in West Dallas, hi.
Well, the better comparison for the First Lady, who really dominated and was actually the president for 2 years, the last 2 years of Woodrow Wilson's presidency, Edith Galt Wilson, Wilson's second wife, was basically president of the United States, did most of the day-to-day work from the White House since Wilson suffered the stroke on his way back from Seattle after trying to campaign for the League of Nations. And now that we've had this epic on Lincoln, do you think we can get from Kathleen Dunn Production Company the life story of Eugene Victor Debs? I think it's important. I think they're companion biographies, and would be nice getting close to the centenary of the speech that sent Debs to prison if we would get an epic film on Debs himself.
All right, Ed, that's another. We want to focus on Lincoln today because he's worth it, but thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Marie in Round Lake, Illinois. Hi, Marie.
Yes, hello. The reason I'm calling is when I was a student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison back in 1960-61, the history professor there said that the Lincoln documents, the records of the Lincoln era, had all been sealed for something like 50 years. Did the film, are those records now open, and did the film draw on any of those records? Because he said, I remember him saying, everybody's going to be really surprised at what went on. Now, this was 1960.
Do you remember who the professor was?
That it is now.
Do you remember the professor, Marie?
Yes, one of the history professors there.
Do you remember the name?
No, I don't.
Oh, well, there's a lot of great teachers teaching there at that time. Well, the answer is that Lincoln's son and conservator of his estate, his son Robert, ordered that his father's papers, which meant his incoming correspondence and letters that he had drafted but never sent, of which there are a few interesting examples. He got angry and wrote angry letters and then put them away, just getting his anger off his chest, but very wisely not mailing those things. Robert Lincoln died in 1922, I believe, and his order was that they be held sealed for 25 years. So in 1947 in Washington, there was a great big ceremony at the Library of Congress, and Carl Sandburg and other great Lincoln writers and scholars of the day literally opened the Lincoln papers. But if they were looking for a smoking gun that implicated extra people in the assassination or had any great revelations, they didn't find them. But they sure found a treasure trove of material that really reflected what people think. It was like the Facebook and Twitter of its day, people writing in on all manner of opinions, and it's all searchable. It's on Abraham Lincoln papers in the Library of Congress. You can read every single piece of paper in that collection today.
More phone calls in a moment. Stay with us if you're online. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. You can also leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our guest is Harold Holzer. Harold has written the companion book for the Steven Spielberg film. He was asked to do so. It is Lincoln, How Abraham Lincoln Ended Slavery in America. Harold is one of the country's leading authorities on Abraham Lincoln. He serves as chair of the Lincoln Bicentennial Foundation, a content consultant to the Steven Spielberg film, and he has authored 42 books, most of them on Abraham Lincoln. We were mentioning Robert, this is from the film. We wanted to play a little bit to give you a feel if you haven't seen the film. Daniel Day-Lewis playing Abraham Lincoln and Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Lincoln's son, Robert. And they're talking about Mary Todd Lincoln had lost a son in the White House and she did not want Robert to serve in the Civil War. This is a conversation between President Lincoln and his son, Robert, talking about Robert's desire to fight in the Civil War.
You drafted half the men in Boston. What do you think their families think about me? The only reason they don't throw things and spit on me is because you're so popular. I can't concentrate on British mercantile law. I don't care about British mercantile law. I might not even want to be a lawyer.
It's a sturdy profession. And a useful one.
Yes, and I want to be useful, but now, not afterwards.
I ain't wearing them things, Mr. Slade. They never fit right.
The missus will have you wear them. Don't think by the...
You're delaying. That's your favorite tactic.
Be useful.
You won't tell me no, but the war will be over in a month.
We have time for a couple more phone calls for Harold Holzer, and let's go to Allison in Milwaukee. Hi, Allison.
Hi. I've seen the movie twice. I saw it noon at the Downer Theater the day it opened, and then I saw it last night again.
Oh, my.
I am so sick of hearing any criticism of it at all, because you've got a top director at the top of his game, two actors who both won two Academy Awards in the top jobs. I'm sick of hearing criticisms that they use great character actors from television and kind of breaks through the fourth wall or something. That's insane, because many of them could have wanted to be associated with the project, could have begged to be associated with the project because they admire Lincoln and they want to see a decent movie made where they're not blowing up trucks and cars and having too much sex and too much violence instead of honoring the people in this country that have done something to make it a great country.
Harold.
I'm with her. I've seen it twice, too. And, you know, every movie uses television character actors now because that's where they work. They have to make money. They're all working in New York on Law and... Well, I guess Law and Order is not around anymore, but those the local New York shows. I thought the character actors were amazing, and I thought Daniel Day-Lewis was beyond belief. So I absolutely agree, and I'm now going to see it a third and a fourth time. I'm doing programs with Tony Kushner here in New York.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Let's go to one more phone call. Mike in Middleton. Hello, Mike.
Hello. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Good. I'm listening to your program as I'm doing the windows, and I believe a comment was made as the timing of the release of the film. It's my understanding that the Republican Party in Lincoln's time would be comparable to what the Democratic Party is today, as far as their philosophies and beliefs and mantras and all things like that. So if that assumption is correct, I could totally understand the release date of this movie.
Harold.
Well, it's a little bit of a simplification, but if you mean just on the basis of, you know, big government versus little government, the Republicans of Lincoln's day believed in executive, in national authority, and the Democrats believed in state authority. The Republicans believed in extending opportunities and not restricting them, and the Democrats, for the most part, believed in restricting them, especially over color. So you can make the case.
And I want to thank you, Harold, so much for being with us. I was looking forward to this hour and to the movie, and thank you for writing the book, because people want to go right to a book after they see this film, or they'll want to go right to the book and then see the film.
It's been a real pleasure to talk to you and your guests as well.
Thanks, Harold. Harold Holzer, our guest this hour. He is one of the country's leading authorities on Abraham Lincoln, and he has written the companion book to the Steven Spielberg film Lincoln, How Abraham Lincoln Ended Slavery in America. Thanks for your calls, everybody. If you haven't seen the film, I hope you'll have a chance to do that and tell me what you think on our Facebook page. I'll be off tomorrow cooking Aunt Margaret's 24-hour salad and Mom's rice and getting ready for Thanksgiving. I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving. We'll be with you again on Monday for All Things Political.